One of the wonderful things about the Mahayana path is that with the mind training teachings, we can apply it to everything in our life. And so no matter what we're doing, from small daily actions that are karmically neutral, that we don't usually have any particular motivation for doing, we can, by practicing thought training, and specifically the gatas, we can transform those neutral actions into virtue so that it increases our merit and increases the imprint of bodhicitta on our mind. Because in every situation, if we want to think of one of the gatas, then it concerns bodhicitta, and that imprint again and again is placed on the mind stream. And another wonderful characteristic of the thought training teachings are that we can use them to transform non-virtuous mental states and non-virtuous actions into something that is useful to us in the path. So once a non-virtuous action has been done, we can't undo it. We need to purify it. But we can still learn something very important from looking back and investigating our non-virtues and understanding how we got involved in them, what we were thinking, what we were expecting, you know, these kinds of things. And in that way, learn more about how our mind works. And then upon seeing the faulty ways of thinking that we have as ordinary beings, to replace those ways of thinking with the mind training teachings. Now, so that, for example, when things, you know, we have suffering or illness or whatever, instead of saying, oh no, how could this happen to me? If we look at it through a karmic perspective, we can say, good, I'm glad this karma is ripening now and it's being done with. And, you know, I can derive some benefit from experiencing this suffering in terms of increasing my compassion and understanding for others. So in short, the thought training teachings have so many ways for us to make even non-virtuous circumstances beneficial on the path, and to transform neutral circumstances into something virtuous on the path. So while we have this opportunity and these precious teachings, then let's try and remember them and use them all in the pursuit of developing bodhicitta. Do you remember the thought training teachings when you have problems? Do you remember the gatas when you're doing dishes or shoveling snow or walking from one building to the next? Yeah. So, yeah, so these are good reminders for us so that we really take advantage of them. You know, for the when you go for full ordination in Taiwan, they really emphasize the gatas, and Venerable Jamba memorized all of the ones in the book. Everybody had to memorize. Did you memorize them? Oh. Okay, so last week we were talking about the spread of Dharma into Sri Lanka and how it evolved in Sri Lanka. Of course, we didn't take it all the way up to the modern day. Some of the ways that, the modern day perspective and how, for example, the Sangha is organized is explained in Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. There's a chapter on history, so you can read it there. but we did go through it when we went through that book. Okay, so now we're on the chapter here about the growth of the Mahayana. And I was trying so hard not to use the words Theravada and Mahayana in this book, and then eventually I just had to just give in because they are commonly used words. But I never use Hinayana. But still, even saying Mahayana, some people don't like that because it implies Hinayana. But it was kind of hard to get around it. Sometimes I said Bodhisattva vehicle. But okay, so Mahayana sutras, which emphasize the Bodhisattva path, began to appear publicly in India in the first century BCE. Some were transmitted to Central Asia. Buddhism began to spread to Central Asia in the 33rd century BCE and later flourished there for many centuries. And then it went from there to China. These sutras were translated into Chinese by the second half of the 2nd century CE. The agamas preserved in the Chinese canon are very early sutras that are remarkably similar to those in the Pali Nikayas. The Nikayas are divisions of sutras in the Pali canon. The word Nikaya also refers to different Theravada groups of monks according to their ordination. So it's a word that has more than one meaning. Okay, with newly discovered Vinaya texts and other scriptures that date from early on, the Pali Canon is no longer seen as the only literature of early Buddhism, although it is the only canon preserved in an Indic language. Okay, now it was very interesting this week as we got, some of you may remember Chris Villy, who was here, and he went to Fukuanshan for a translator's course, and he wrote up a little bit about his experience, and apparently somebody who was there said that a lot of the Chinese didn't translate so many sutras from Sanskrit. They were mostly in Parthian, which is the language spoken in Iran. I am not so sure about that. I'm quite skeptical about that because that person said that the Sanskrit sutras were just kind of a mess and it was difficult to translate them. But I don't think so. Why? Because centuries after Buddhism went to China, the Tibetans were translating from Sanskrit to Tibetan. If the sutras were really in such bad language that they couldn't be translated in the 2nd century AD, they weren't going to have good language by the time you get to the 6th, 7th, and 8th centuries. Okay. Also, the Chinese who went by the sea route, as we learned when we were in India, many of them stopped at Jambi to learn Sanskrit before they went to Nalanda. And so I think any of the very well-known people who went to China to get texts and then brought them back and translated them, like Xuanzang, definitely spoke, familiar with Sanskrit because that was the language that was used in Nalanda Monastery and so forth. They didn't write in Parthian there. Parthian was, thousands of miles away. So, yes, they found some scriptures, in Gandhari and some of the Central Asian languages. So some of those may have been from those languages translated into Chinese, but I think the majority were from Sanskrit. My personal opinion, even though I'm not a scholar, but it, yeah.
He's trying to get the talk for
us. Yeah, but the thing what I've learned is just because somebody says something, it doesn't mean it's true. Okay, and especially academics who study Buddhism, yeah, they look at certain aspects, they make conclusions, but they don't really know what Buddhism is like on the ground. Yeah, and so for that reason, I don't usually read many of the literature that was translated from by Western academics, unless they're like, you know, Jeffrey's students, because I know he's a practitioner and, you know, his those translations are good. But this thing also was saying how some of the early translators did a very good job.
Oh,
yes. I can't understand their stuff when they talk about, when they translate. I have a very different take on it, you know. So, yeah. So, I mean, within academia, you have, everybody has their own ideas, and, you know. So, anyway, those are mine, and I'm not in academia. Okay. But really, you know, if Sanskrit was in such bad shape, how are the Tibetans translating from Sanskrit into Tibetan 5 centuries later? Yeah, doesn't make any sense. Okay, academic scholars as well as practitioners of the Pali tradition have questioned the authenticity of the Mahayana Sutras, asserting that they were not spoken by the Buddha, but were written later over a span of several centuries. So there are even, I mean, many of our friends who, I don't know what Jeffrey would say, but Jay Garfield, I'm sure, you know, Guy, these people all say, yeah, you know, the Mahayana Sutras were made up later and then, you know, falsely attributed to the Buddha. And the reasons they give is because unlike the Pali Sutras, you know, which you could tell were arranged so that they could be passed down orally, because you have all these stock passages that you memorize one time and then you got it for all the sutras. Mahayana doesn't have much of that. So it indicates that it was already a written tradition, and so they didn't need to, you know, make it with these stock passages for easy memory. And also, they say that because in many Mahayana sutras, it says at the end, it encourages people to write the sutras and copy them out. Yeah, and so they say, so that indicates that these sutras came about much later because at the Buddha's time, you know, reading and writing were not prominent. Okay. His Holiness has a very different view. I think we put it in Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions, but His Holiness's view, which I was, you know, wondering, should I really put this in the book because it's so different than what the academics think, and the academics will just go, bleh. But I said, you know, it's His Holiness's book. He said it. I heard him. We'll put it in. So his idea was, you know, first of all, that the Mahayana Sutras were taught at the same time as the Pali Sutras, yeah, but they were often taught to a very different audience. So if you take the Heart Sutra, for example, the audience was not just a group of monks and nuns. It was, you know, you had the yakshas and you had the bodhisattvas sitting in space and you had, you know, all sorts of different kinds of beings there. So it was a very different audience because the meaning of the Mahayana was it wasn't for everybody at the time that the Buddha lived. Okay, so this is the, you know, what the Mahayanists believe. And also His Holiness says that even when, if Buddha taught them to monks or to lay people, the Mahayana Sutras, he said somebody must have known how to read and write, because they did have it for the government. You know, they didn't write novels and things like that, but they did have reading and writing for government functions, to keep the books, to write down laws and certain things like that. And so His Holiness's idea is that somebody, you know, would hear the Buddha say that, teach this, go back and then, you know, write it down themselves. But understanding that these teachings were not to be widespread because they weren't suitable for everybody, kept it very private. And then several centuries later, when the whole climate changed, then they would bring out these texts that had been written down and kept secret. So that was His Holiness's theory. Yeah. Again, this is an interesting point that, you know, when you study with the Tibetans, they will go to great lengths to prove that the Mahayana is the teachings of the Buddha. I mean, it's really important to them. And, you know, you start out with In Precious Garland, which is a very early Mahayana text. Nagarjuna has a whole section there, remember, on why the Mahayana is the teachings of the Buddha. So, you know, it's been a controversy for many centuries, you know, starting even before Nagarjuna, and he was like 2nd century AD, you know, very early. So, yeah, so there's always been this kind of controversy and yeah, what's going on. But, oh, so back to what I was saying. So when we were studying Ornament of Clear Realizations, you know, Geshe Tektok was, you know, again, you know, the reasons why these are the teachings of the Buddha and these 21 commentaries and, you know, it's Mahayana and the teachings of the Buddha. But again, us Westerners were there and we're kind of going, well, we don't really care, you know, about where the origin of it is. We want to know what it says. And if it says something reasonable, then we'll believe it. And if it says something that's not reasonable, we won't believe it, you know. But for the Tibetans, for that way of looking at it, you know, first you have to prove its authenticity, and then that establishes it as a credible text. Whereas for us, you know, coming from the outside, you know, authenticity, yeah, well, yeah, it's nice, but we don't really care. We want to know what it says, and if it talks about something that is really helpful and useful, then that's good, and we'll follow it. Okay? So this is kind of following up on my example from yesterday about differences in how Tibetans and Westerners study. Okay. Okay, so one of the chief reasons for the claim that the Mahayana was not the word of the Buddha is that the Pali Suttas were more publicly known and widespread in the early centuries than the Mahayana Sutras. The discovery in Pakistan and Afghanistan over the last few decades of many Buddhist manuscripts that date from the end of the 1st century BCE has changed academic scholars' view of the Mahayana. The newly found manuscripts written in Gandhari Prakrit are older than any previously discovered manuscripts. Many of them are from the Dharmaguptaka school, and some are Mahayana sutras. Although some of these texts are called early Mahayana or proto-Mahayana, their ideas and presentations of the Bodhisattva path are mature. With the revision in the dates of the Buddha's life to later than previously thought and the discovery of older Mahayana texts, modern scholars are reconsidering their ideas concerning the Mahayana sutras. Okay? It's like I was saying before, they used to think the Buddha lived 6th century BCE. Now it's moved more to like 5th century. Yeah, at least the academic scholars. I think for the traditions, they just set their date and it never changes. But the academic scholars, you know, will change their idea on that. So they're making the Buddha's life a little bit later and then finding some of these scriptures that are older. So then the distance between the Buddha's lifetime and those scriptures or the amount of time is shortening. Okay. When previously unknown Bodhisattva sutras first appeared publicly and for several centuries afterwards, Mahayana was not identified as a separate tradition within Buddhism. So these Bodhisattva sutras, you know, that spoke about Bodhisattvas, they weren't called Mahayana when they came out. You know, they were just sutras. Maybe they called them Bodhisattva sutras. But Mahayana was not a special school at the time these sutras became more public. Okay? So Mahayana at the beginning referred to the goal of the path, Buddhahood, rather than the attainment of arhatship that was prominent in the early sutras. Okay? So first, Mahayana referred to the goal of your meditation. Yeah? Yeah. Then, as time went on, Mahayana began to refer to a body of literature. Okay, so it went from a goal in your of your spiritual path to a body of literature. And in the 4th century, a sangha used it to indicate scriptures explaining the path of a bodhisattva. Okay, so it developed into now a certain genre of scriptures that talk about the bodhisattva path. By the 6th century, people were calling themselves Mahayanas, indicating that they saw themselves as a distinct Buddhist group. So that didn't happen until the 6th century. Yeah? However, due to the great number of Mahayana scriptures and the broad distance over which they spread, it seems that their followers did not become a single unified group in India, nor was there any Mahayana canon ever compiled in India, to our knowledge. So that's an interesting thing, you know, because you had the transmission to Ceylon, and then they organized it into a canon. They didn't seal the canon until the 5th century CE, so for 1,000 years it was open. But in India, they never brought together the Mahayana sutras and made a canon, which is very curious. You know, why didn't they do that? Was it just because the sutras were so popular that, you know, they didn't see any need to bring them together? Or maybe they did bring them together, but when Nalanda and the big monasteries were destroyed, you know, all of that was destroyed together with them. Yeah. But it's an interesting thing that, you know, because we only have 3 extant canons now. The Pali canon, and that's the only one in the Indic language. Then the Chinese canon and the Tibetan canon. Yeah, so many, you know, all those other 18 schools in northern India. Yeah, we don't know what happened to their canons and how many, you know, how many of them had really separate canons, how many didn't. We have no idea, you know. And similarly, with all these Mahayana sutras coming out, you know, we don't know. Are all of them really extant today, or did some get lost, you know, on the pathway through the Gobi Desert or, you know, on the ocean or what?
Did you come across anything as to who was writing the scriptures and how many people actually read them? Were they published and distributed to the average person?
You mean the Mahayana ones?
Yeah, the Mahayana.
Okay. So the idea that they were written by other people, that is the idea of the scholars and the Theravadas. The Tibetans say absolutely not, they were taught by the Buddha. Okay? Yeah, and the Chinese would say too, they were taught by the Buddha. So as far as the ones that they think other people wrote, I have no idea who they think wrote them. Whoever, you know, if that's true, those people, you know, they didn't put their names on them, so they were very humble. But it makes you think, you know, if they had different ideas, why didn't they write treatises or commentaries and put their names on them like the Indian sages did when they wrote treatises and commentaries? Yeah. So I don't know. You know, we really don't know. So, you know, whoever gets clairvoyant, or I should say the super knowledge powers, and can see great distances in the past, please let us know the answers to these questions, you know. Yeah, it also could have been they didn't make a canon because it was the Mahayana spread so widely, you know, because by the time that it became known as its own school, that 6th century, it was already in China for many, many centuries. It was going into Tibet, you know. It had spread down to Ceylon. They had Mahayana sutras by that time, except, well, they had Mahayana sutras quite early, and then, of course, the king, you know, burnt them or something like that. I don't know. Okay, so Mahayana, okay, was not a religion, and it did not have distinct institutions. Okay, so it wasn't a separate religion. It didn't have distinct institutions like the Vatican, you know, who ran everything. It had no specific geographical location where its hierarchy was predominant. Okay, so it was really spread out. You know, it wasn't a school, you know, and here's your Buddhist pope, and we're making a canon, and, you know, and it's located here, and these are the titles of all the big shots. Nothing like that. It was really quite widespread. So it makes you wonder, was that because maybe of the content of some of the Bodhisattva sutras, the fact that they... because it seems like at some point some of the lay people felt left out of the way the Pali tradition had organized itself around the monastics, and the lay people wanted to be included more. So maybe the Mahayana sutras, you know, because they were spoken to monastics, to bodhisattvas, many bodhisattvas. Some were monastics, some were not monastics. So, you know, maybe because it was more widespread like that, then it didn't have an institution and a commander in chief. I don't know. Okay. Monastics following the Shravaka vehicle and Bodhisattva vehicle lived together and probably recited the Pratimoksha, the monastic precepts, together. So this is in the early days when Mahayana first began to appear and it was a goal in your spiritual practice. Then you had, you know, Bodhisattva monastics and Shravaka monastics living at the same monastery. You know, they got along perfectly well. Yeah. Except regarding the spatulas. But, you know, they didn't argue about the teachings. And it looks like, you know, they recited the Pratimoksha together. And as we all know, that if the Sangha is not in harmony, it cannot recite the Pratimoksha together. Yeah. So so it's very interesting. If you have a chance to read Jan Natier's translation of the Urga Sutra called All the Good Men, it's quite interesting. A few good men. Okay. So It's very, very interesting, you know, because she talks about this, because that sutra was one of the early Bodhisattva sutras. Yeah. And so she could see, you know, how it was describing how Bodhisattvas should practice. And it really wasn't that all that different from how the Shravakas could, except it seems like sometimes the Bodhisattvas were encouraged to be to meditate alone more, which you would think would be the opposite, you know, if they were practicing bodhicitta, that they would, you know, have a thrift store and a soup kitchen and something like that, you know, that they would. But no. But actually, you know, in Asia, that's not the way society was organized. They didn't have volunteer organizations because and social welfare projects like that, not very many, because the family was the chief unit, and if you had a problem, your family helped you. Yeah. And Rinchen Kadro explained to me, you know, that even up to, you know, all through, I mean, she was born in Tibet and grew up there, you know, the families, they just took care of everybody, and that it was a big change coming into exile and the Tibetan government having to set up, you know, the Tibetan children's village and the old folks home and all these welfare projects, because that's not what they did in old Tibet. Yeah, quite different. Yeah,
I'm wondering about these monks living together, because if tantra is practiced, you can't stay with a shravaka.
Yeah, but this was early on when the Mahayana sutras first began to appear. So at that time, tantra was not widespread. I don't think it was, no, because first the Mahayana sutras came and people started practicing that. And then after that, a few centuries after that, that's when tantra really began to spread. You know, in the early years, it was not very prevalent. Yeah. Also, you know, I wonder, I haven't done any research on the tantric precepts, but the Bodhisattva precepts, for example, they were collated from many different sutras. You know, Asanga spoke some, and Shantideva had some, and Chandragoman found some, and put them together. And so I wonder if the tantric precepts were made like that, or if they all come from one tantra and was just extracted from one tantra, or if somebody, again, collated them from different tantras. I have no idea.
Venerable, do you know when and how then the Shravakas and the Bodhisattvas starting practicing separately, like if they were now at this point practicing together in the same monasteries, and when did that become different?
Yeah, well, I would say at least by the 6th century when the Mahayanas started saying, I'm a Mahayanist. Yeah, so let's go back to that paragraph. Okay, so as time went on, so at the beginning, it was just your spiritual goal. As time went on, Mahayana began to refer to a body of literature. So it's just the scriptures. It's not a separate school. And in the 4th century, a Sangha used it to indicate scriptures explaining the path of a bodhisattva. So by 4th century, it was becoming a scriptural tradition. Okay, but it wasn't its own religion separated out from anybody, was it, you know? Okay, by the 6th century, people were calling themselves Mahayanas, indicating that they saw themselves as a distinct Buddhist group. So by the 6th century, Nagarjuna was 2nd century, Vasubandhu and Asanga were 4th century. Okay, so by the 6th century, so that's, you know, when they really started seeing themselves as a separate school. Yeah, although at Nalanda, they had everybody, even non-Buddhists at Nalanda. And even nuns. I read something that said they had nuns at Nalanda. Yeah. No, but Nalanda was an educational institution, and they, you know, debate was such a big thing. So they loved having all these people with different views come there. Okay. It's really much, much later that this thing began of, you know, okay, well, we're Theravadas and you're Mahayanas and that kind of stuff.
Page 89, it says, in India and sometimes Sri Lanka, prior to the 12th century, the Shravaka vehicle and Mahayana flourished together.
Yeah.
So at least to the, no, it sounds like to the 12th
yeah.
century. That's yeah. Page 89.
Okay, so even though people may by the 6th century have started seeing themselves as a special, a different tradition, you know, still they practiced together, did stuff together, and so on, okay? Okay, so, you know, it changes our way of thinking because we know what the present situation is. And it wasn't like that centuries ago. Yeah, so we have to switch a little bit. Okay. In the 5th to 12th centuries, the great Buddhist universities such as Nalanda, Vikramasila, and Odantapuri, where Buddhism flourished, were inhabited by monastics and lay practitioners from many different branches, sects, and schools of Buddhism. They studied and debated the Buddhist teachings, learning from each other. Okay? So very ecumenical, you know, that way. Mahayana scriptures contain, and as it'll come up later, you know, when we come into Tibetan Buddhism and we learn, okay, there's four philosophical tenet schools of Vibhasaka, the Svatantrika, the Chittamatra, the Majjhimaka, and the Svatantrikas have two branches, and the Majjhimaka have two branches, and one of the Majjhimaka branches also have two branches. And here is the catechism from each of those branches. You know, the Svatantrikas, having reasoning, they believe, and the Svatantrikas, you know, with scripture, they believe, you know, and it's all set out as if it's all laid down in concrete, you know, and as if, you know, there were people kind of, I'm a card-carrying Svatantrika, and so this is what I believe in. I'm a Svatantrika following reasoning, and those ones follow scripture. You know, we're totally different from them. You know, we use reasoning. We're following Dharmakirti. Dharmakirti is one of ours, except Dharmakirti actually was a Chittamadran. Yeah. But, you know, some of the ones who you have a Sangha who wrote Abhidharma Kosha from a Vaivasika viewpoint. He wrote the commentary from a Svatantrika viewpoint, but he himself was a Chittamadran. Yeah? So, you know, we hear these things like they're all cast in concrete, but you know, when you read the history, you know, they all kind of lived together. They talked to each other. They debated. They didn't have any big set catechism that you had to put your hand on top of, you know, and swear to always follow this belief and not any other belief. So help you, Buddha. You know, there was none of that. Yeah. And so actually, you know, that in later years, they started, you know, some groups calling themselves Svatantrikas and some Madhyamikas and so on and so forth. But this very rigid definition is actually was done in Tibet as a pedagogical tool. And as a pedagogical tool, it's brilliant, you know, because you have these things, nice, clean, clear, statements, what they believe in, and then you start at the first one and you practice and you watch your attitude change, and, you know, what's the nature of phenomena? Vibhasikas don't challenge that so much. They just talk about the person. The tantrika is similar. Then Chitta Madhran Kamal, and you have to think about the selflessness of phenomena, and so on. So it's a pedagogical tool to help you grow in your understanding of the nature of reality and of the paths and stages. It's a brilliant system. But that didn't come all set up like that from India. Yeah. There was... Aryadeva wrote something about the tenant systems. Yeah, the Tibetans say, well, it's the Aryadeva who was Nagarjuna's student. But actually, in the 11th, 12th century, there was another Nagarjuna. There was another Aryadeva. There was this whole rash of scholars appearing, having the same names as the very early ones. And they don't know if, you know, they just by accident had those names, or if they took those names and that validated some of what they were teaching. Okay. But, you know, the Aryadeva who wrote some of the things about the different tenet systems was probably the later one. You know, it couldn't have been the Aryadeva that was Nagarjuna's student, because Chittamatra wasn't even alive then. Yeah, Chittamatra was taught by a Sangha who was 4th century. Nagarjuna was 2nd century. Actually, you know what? Nalanda wasn't even very well established by 2nd century. Yeah. So, you know, we call Nagarjuna as a Nalanda monk, but Nalanda was pretty small back in those days. Yeah, we don't really know what it was like. Okay, so all these people, you know, they lived together, they learned from each other, they debated. Hmm. Mahayana scriptures contain many philosophical positions and practices. It has never been a monolithic doctrine. Although those who self-identify as Mahayanists have shared beliefs such as the Bodhisattva path and practices, okay. But as Mahayanists, you know, okay, the method side of the path very similar in the different Buddhist traditions, you know, not totally, but very similar. The wisdom aspect of the path. Yeah, very different. You know, you have Madhyamakas, you have Chittamadrans. How Chittamadra is explained in Tibet is different than how it is taught in China. Okay. And what was a big shocker for me was, you know, after I had read all the nice, you know, tenet system things about what Chittamadrans believe, when, you know, you study Lekshe Nyingpo, then you realize that the Tibetans are in the process of figuring out what they think the Chittamadrans are saying. So a lot of the Chittamadra that we're taught isn't necessarily from Asanga and Vasubandhu's books, but it's the later Tibetans reading the Indians and saying, oh, well, since they said this, they must have also believed X, Y, Z. Okay? And the whole division between Svatantrikas and Prasangikas that we spend years on, yeah, it was not known as two different branches in India. That was done in Tibet with Jay Rinpoche. Yeah. So all these arisings of different schools, yeah, these are things that happen slowly, yeah, and gradually as, you know, people have new ideas and they teach them to other people and groups form and somebody breaks off and they start something new. And, you know, here in America, I mean, talk about the evolution of different religions, you know, the way Americans do it. You know, I disagree with you, I leave and I start my new religion. it's incorporated, it has a catechism, and, you know, you belong to my church and you don't go to anybody else's church. Okay? And if you look about the history of religion in America, that's kind of what it's like. You know, all these people, I'm way off topic, but I think it's interesting. It, all these people who didn't fit in their own countries, those are the people who came here. Yeah, not the open, tolerant, accepting people who were fine living in Europe with different views. It's all the people who didn't fit in there, who were rigid and strict and said, my religion. You know, I mean, the pilgrims? Yeah, you know, they were getting persecuted. Nobody likes us. We're coming to America. We're landing on Plymouth Rock. This is our rock. Yeah, we don't rock and roll, but it is our rock. Yeah, and if you look, you know, historically, you know, how many divisions of Baptists do we have in America? How many divisions of Methodists, of Presbyterians? Yeah. The Catholics, you don't have so many because they have a pope and they keep you in line. But the other ones, you know, really. I mean, the Baptists keep you in line too. You have your Southern Baptist Conference. But, you know, if you want to start a new religion, you just leave and you go and incorporate it and you get some followers and you're good to go. And, you know, this is what Americans have done. In Europe, you don't have nearly as many subsects and sub-traditions and new religions and things like we do. Yeah? I mean, look, Mormonism, you know, America invented it. I don't know Seventh-day Adventists. I don't know much about the history of all these religions, but, you know, in Asia, you know, people are much more relaxed. And His Holiness always praises India now for being very secular. And to him, secular doesn't mean non-religious like secular means here. To His Holiness, secular means accepting of all religions. You know, and it's really been in recent years you know, that the problems between different groups have gotten so horrible. You know, I mean, it started kind of when India and Pakistan split up. But a lot of that we owe to the British.
Yeah, I agree. There's much more I have never heard of when I came here, many more groups. But it's a small subtopic, but every time when I entered the U.S., I got greeted as a nun, and a very respectful, even so the officers didn't know what Buddhism is. When I go into Germany, nothing of it, even more than crazy looks like, what's that? So the tolerance I found here, just from my personal experiences meeting Americans, is much bigger.
Oh, that's good. That's very good. You're lucky. I walk down the street, they say Hare Krishna. No, in the U.S. In the U.S., you know. You walk down, I remember people going, Hare Krishna. No, I'm not Hare Krishna. Okay. Okay, so Mahayana wasn't a religion. It didn't have distinct institutions. It didn't even have its own canon. Okay. It had many different philosophical positions, many different practices. And as the Mahayana tradition spread in different Asian countries, you know, it really changed a lot according to, you know, people emphasizing different scriptures, people bringing out different practices, you know, and you're getting this whole, you know, diversity of different traditions. So the early Mahayana scriptures were not limited to one language, appearing in Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, Buddhist Sanskrit, classical Sanskrit, and Gandhari. Okay? So it wasn't even in one language. While many Mahayana scriptures were in Sanskrit, not all Sanskrit scriptures are Mahayana. Some teach the Shravaka vehicle. Mahayana did not dismiss the Shravaka vehicle, texts, or teachings. In fact, it taught that the Bodhisattva path is based on a thorough understanding of the four truths of the Aryas, the 37 harmonies with awakening, the three higher trainings, the four immeasurables, serenity and insight. So many ideas are held in common between the Shravaka vehicle and the Mahayana, and all Buddhists, no matter what tradition they belong to, take refuge in the three jewels. Okay, so it wasn't like Mahayana appeared and said, okay, we're a different school, you Shravakas, we don't believe anything that you believe. So many things, I mean, all these basic principles, yeah, they're in the Mahayana and in the Shravaka vehicle. And when you really start studying it, it's really quite amazing. And like I've said before, you can see when you read some of the Pali texts, how the Mahayana just built on top of that. You know, many things, they just built on top of it and expanded the meaning of what was said very briefly, in one of the Buddha's discourses. Yeah, I mean, even His Holiness talks about that, you know, because he'll say the first turning of the Dharma wheels was primarily the Pali Sutra scriptures, primarily, not all. And then the second Dharma wheel expanded on the meaning of true cessation, and the third Dharma wheel expanded on the meaning of true paths. So even though the Pali tradition people don't accept the sutras of the second and third Dharma wheels, you know, all they're basically doing is expanding upon the last two of the four truths. Okay. While most Mahayana sutras appeared publicly after the Pali Suttas, some appeared before some scriptures in the Pali canon. So that's interesting. Yeah, the Pali canon contains texts from many time periods, ranging from the Buddha's time until it became a closed canon 10 centuries later. The commentaries in the Pali canon were written later than some of the Mahayana treatises and commentaries, such as the Mahayana treatises and commentaries by Nagarjuna, Vasubandhu, Buddhapalita, and so forth. The earliest scriptures recently discovered in Pakistan and Afghanistan were from both the Shravaka vehicle and the Mahayana. And remember before we read that many sutras, they didn't say what school they were from at the end. Yeah. In short, many Buddhist schools developed over a long period of time. They had both overlapping and distinct tenets and scriptures. Buddha Dharma was and still is a living, dynamic tradition. But you do see as time goes on how people want to pin things down. Yeah, more and more we have to pin things down. And in one way, that's good. It prevents the Dharma from degenerating. In another way, it, you know, breaks people up into different groups more and more.
Did this pinning down start in India, or did it start after things were leaving India?
I imagine some of it started in India. I mean, if you had 18 schools. Yeah. But, I think it got more and more pinned down, which is natural, you know. That's how things develop. Okay, Mahayana is not an ordination order or a lineage. an ordination lineage. This is something that's really important. I'll read the paragraph and then I'll come back and talk more about it. There is no such thing as Mahayana Vinaya or Mahayana monastic ordination. From early times until the present, Mahayana practitioners have ordained in the Vinaya traditions of the 18 schools. A Sangha in the Sarvastivadin, Vimuktisena in the Samyutiya, Atisha in the Mahasangikas, and so forth. The Chinese pilgrims spoke of some of the monasteries of their time as Mahayana Stavira. And Stavira, you know, means the elders, yeah, which in Pali is Theravada, but they're, you know, they're not exactly the same. While we aren't sure about the meaning of that term, Mahayana Stavira, it could refer to monastics who were ordained in the Stavira Vinaya, the lineage of today's Theravada, and practiced Mahayana. Mahayana monastics live in monasteries, follow the ethical conduct prescribed in the Vinaya, and conduct monastic rites in accordance with the Vinaya. Practicing the Bodhisattva vehicle does not make one ethically lax. In fact, in addition to the various sets of Pratimoksha precepts, such as the five lay precepts and monastic precepts, Mahayana practitioners also take the Bodhisattva precepts. Okay, now, one of the big things regarding Bhikshuni ordination and the hesitancy of our friends from the Theravada tradition, to restart it. It has been restarted, you know. But they didn't want to go to Taiwan to take the Dharma, get the Bhikshuni ordination from the Dharmaguptaka, even though the Chinese Bhikshuni lineage comes from Sri Lanka many centuries ago. We don't know exactly which Vinaya lineage it was who went. But anyway, the people in the Theravada countries were saying, that's Mahayana Vinaya. So, you know, we're not Mahayanas. We're not going to take that ordination, you know, from the Chinese and reinstitute the Bhikshuni ordination that way. And so we spent many, many hours trying to explain that there isn't a Mahayana Vinaya, you know, because, and this is the way it's explained in our tradition, that our monastic ordination, yeah, it's all according to the Shravakayana, you know, the Shravaka vehicle, you know, because the level of the ordination is, you know, with those 18 schools, the Mahayana wasn't up and running and widespread at that time. Yeah. And so our monastic ordination we consider to be, you know, on the equal level of, the Theravada and so forth, because it's all from the 18 early schools. But the Theravadas were looking at the Chinese, Korean, and Tibetan monastics. You are Mahayana monastics. You have a Mahayana Vinaya. Yeah. And so, I know that this was a big thing for Achen Brahm and I think Bhikkhu Bodhi, you know, also. I don't know how well some of the other Asian monks, how much that idea got through to them. I don't think it got through very much in Thailand, maybe more in Sri Lanka, because they were the ones who reestablished the Bhikshuni lineage in that school. But this is something very important so that when you speak, you know, with other people from different traditions, and they ask about it, you know, no, our ordination is on equal par with all the other monastic ordinations. It's not a Mahayana ordination.
Mm-hmm. You take the Bodhisattva vows in Taiwan. How does that, can you, because the platform that's included in the ordination ritual.
You're talking about in the Chinese tradition.
Yeah.
In the Chinese tradition, yeah, that you have triple platforms. So you take your shamanary precepts again. You've taken them before, you take them again. Then you take Bhikshuni, then you take Bodhisattva. They're just, you know, doing all of those at the same time. They're not saying that those are all Mahayana lineages. You know, the Dharma, the Shramaneri and the Bhikshuni ordination are from the Dharma Guptaka Vinaya. The Bodhisattva vows are not. Yeah, those are the Mahayana precepts.
So could one who goes to Taiwan say, I don't want to take the Bodhisattva precepts?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can go for two of the platforms and not the third. You know, it's just that it became so prominent in Taiwan that they just steered everybody in that school, okay? Yeah, it kind of be like the Tibetans too, you know. You have a Tibetan that doesn't take the Bodhisattva precept. You theoretically could, you know, and there are people, I mean, like when Westerners start practicing Tibetan Buddhism, I don't push the Bodhisattva precepts on them or the Tantric precepts. It's got to be a gradual thing, yeah. But, but they're all different lineages of precepts, and there are different levels of precepts. Yeah, the Pratimoksha precepts you break by actions of body and speech. The Bodhisattva precepts you can also break by just the action of your mind. It doesn't have to be body and speech. Tantric precepts are even more difficult to keep because those, you know, not all of them, but more of them emphasize the mind's activities. Okay. So they're quite different. Also, your Pratimoksha precepts, you take just for this life. Bodhisattva and Tantric precepts, you take until you attain full awakening. Yeah, quite different. That's why when you take the Pratimoksha precepts, you do that visualization of the light coming and you have a precept body afterwards. You don't get a precept body for the Bodhisattva and Tantric precepts. Yeah, because when you have a precept body, it's a subtle form. And when you die, that form ends. You know, if you're a monastic in this life, when you get born in your next life, you are no longer a monastic, you know. Huh? I know. Many of us would like to come out of the womb as monastics. So we pray to at least meet the Dharma early and, you know, be able to take the precepts early. But, you know, the Pratimoksha, you have a precept body and you lose those precepts at the time of death. The Bodhisattva and Tantric precepts, you don't lose at the time of death. Yeah. So also the visualization, you know, when you take them is different. Okay, let's see if we can finish this section. Who knows? Okay, we'll finish it sometime. Okay. While most Mahayana sutras publicly appeared, all the way down here. Woo. Calling Theravada mainstream Buddhism is incorrect and confusing. So there's one Theravada bhikkhu, yeah, who he got in with some of the people who were writing the history books for university, and he started calling early Buddhism, you know, mainstream Buddhism. And the Theravada is a descendant of that, so it's all mainstream. And Mahayana is this kind of oddball thing that came up later. Which other scholars read that, and they say, excuse us, but in India, during the classical period in India, Mahayana was mainstream. And Theravada was down in, you know, Ceylon. And there were many more Mahayanists in India than Theravadas. So your calling it mainstream is not correct, but he has his own ways. So calling Theravada mainstream Buddhism is incorrect and confusing. Yeah, because in each location and at each time period, one or another school may be more well-established. There were at least 18 schools that all saw themselves as mainstream Buddhism in their own locales. Okay. Mahayana was well-received and flourished all over India and Central Asia and spread to East Asia, Sri Lanka, Southeast Asia, and Indonesia. Contrary to being a minority movement, it was mainstream. The Mahayana and Shravaka vehicle both include rituals, chanting, mantras, and dharanis. I finally found out, what do I have here in note 23 for dharani? I looked it up in the Princeton Dictionary today because it's been a term that's always puzzled me. It's just referring to one of the things I quoted. It's not explaining what. So a dharani is a, I learned a new word, mnemonic device. It starts MN, so don't ask me how to spell the rest of it. But it's a mnemonic device to help you remember profound teachings. So some dharanis are like mantras, and they incorporate the meaning of a large body of knowledge. And then other dharanis, I didn't get to read the whole thing in Princeton Dictionary, so I'll have to read that and then tell you more about the other meanings of dharanis. But there, it's all to get help you memorize or remember the different meanings of the teachings. Okay. So all of the vehicles include dharanis. Both Mahayana and Shravaka vehicle show reverence in the presence of stupas, statues, paintings, and relics. While many Mahayana sutras emphasize the importance of copying those sutras, practitioners of both vehicles engaged in the activity of copying sutras. In India and sometimes in Sri Lanka, prior to the 12th century, the Shravaka vehicle and Mahayana flourished together. Practitioners of both vehicles often lived together in the same monastery, received monastic ordination in the same lineage, and performed the Vinaya rituals together. They shared many common texts and tenets and debated their unique ones. Both developed commentarial traditions, although the interpretations sometimes differed. The two vehicles had some differences as well in areas such as the principal sutras they studied, the intention for practice, the view of the ultimate nature, the path, and the result. Most of the Shravaka vehicle lineages in India disappeared over time due to a variety of conditions such as the political rise of the Brahmins, changes in government structure, the popularity of Hinduism, and the monastics' lack of involvement in the lives of the lay people. His Holiness emphasizes this a lot when he talks about, how Buddhism was overcome in India, you know, because you had these large bodies of monasteries with, the monastics in them, and people stayed to themselves. They didn't go out into the lay community so much and teach. So when the invaders came and burnt Nalanda and Odantapura and Vikramashila and so on, they destroyed the scriptures, they killed the monks, there was nothing left in the village to continue the existence of the Dharma, because it had been so centrally located in the monasteries. And this was a point that came up in 1990 when there was a Jewish delegation that went to Dharamsala. And His Holiness met several times with them. And one of the things that he was very interested in is, how have you kept your religion up? You've been in exile and diaspora since, you know, over 2,000 years. I can't remember when they burned down the temple. But, you know, long time you've been in diaspora. And your religion still exists. How did you do it? Yeah, you're spread out all over. You don't have your own country anymore. Your situation is like us Tibetans. And the answer was that many of the rituals were done at home. Yeah? And so Friday night, welcoming the Shabbos, everybody gets together, they dance, they sing to welcome the Shabbos. The family has a special meal. They do lots of prayers and tell the religious stories on Friday evening. Saturday, nobody works. You don't turn on electricity, anything. You study the Torah all the day, the whole day long. Okay? So many things were in the home and were in the lay community, so that then wherever Jews went, Judaism went with them. Whereas in India, it was so condensed into where the monastic universities were that when those were destroyed, you know, most of the villages, the people were, you know, they were followers of the Brahmins, or they were Hindus, or whatever. Okay. Later on, many of these same factors also affected Mahayana groups. While Buddhism largely disappeared in India by the early 13th century, both the Sanskrit and Pali traditions have spread widely throughout Asia and beyond. Yeah. So Buddhism was really decimated there, and thank goodness it had gone into China, into Tibet, into Korea, and Japan, and Southeast Asia, and, you know, and was really existing and flourishing in those other places. Otherwise, we would have been really sunk.
I've been wondering about the Buddhism coming to the West and, you know, translating into English, and the instances where people avoid words that's, you know, loaded with Christian things, mm-hmm. and how is that an advantage or not? Because like when it went into China, it basically assume a lot of the language,
yeah.
And then there isn't that conflict. Like people don't have aversion to Taoist terms being Buddhified in that way, mm-hmm. and then that language became, because the comment that I kept hearing was people like the Tibetan and Chinese, mm-hmm. the language has Dharma in it. Whereas, mm-hmm. like in a Western language, in English, it mm-hmm. doesn't have, it's not marinated in
yeah.
the Dharma enough, and then so it doesn't have that kind of.
Yeah. Well, you have to remember that Buddhism has been in Tibet and China a lot longer than it's been here. Okay? So when it first got translated into Chinese, they were using Taoist terms. Some people got confused. And so they really had to also, the monastics also had to step up and explain what those terms meant from a Buddhist viewpoint, you know, because otherwise people started thinking along Taoist lines or even Confucianist lines, yeah. In Tibet, very few of the lay people can understand the scriptures. Because, and I think in China too, because it's written in classical Tibetan or classical Chinese, and that's not the common language. Yeah, so it's, they really need, I know in the Tibetan community, Jinpa was talking about it, you know, writing Dharma books in common language Tibetan that the lay people can understand. Yeah. And I know that some people were translating Lamrim Chenmo into Chinese in a more colloquial way so that people could understand it. Yeah. So it's always difficult working with language. Yeah. But of course, after it's been there for some time, then you see the, you can recognize the Dharma terms, you know, some of the Dharma terms anyway, in the main language. Yeah. And so here, you know, some people say, well, let's just use Christian terms in the same way as in China, where they use Taoist terms. But then some of us say, we don't think that's a very good idea because those, some of those words are really very, very loaded, and using that vocabulary will push people away. I see a number of people nodding their heads in agreement. Yeah. So, because it's already, you know, we find in teaching Westerners the Dharma, so often we have to really go back and say, like if you teach about karma, this is what karma means in Buddhism. It's not the same as original sin. It's not the same as predetermination. Okay? They're very, very different ideas. Yeah. So there's many things like that that you really have to, you know, the meaning of compassion, how you're supposed to feel when you're compassionate. Yeah. I mean, in Christianity, to be compassionate, you have to be hanging on a cross. Otherwise, if you have the least bit of joy yourself, you're being selfish and you can't be compassionate. Whereas in Buddhism, you know, the bodhisattvas are very joyful and very compassionate. Okay. So there's many things like that where you really have to go over and explain. And I found you have to explain to the same people many, many times. It doesn't get through the first time, because when you grow up with certain ideas, when you were educated in a certain religion, some of that stuff, you know, it hangs on to you for a long time. And you need to really go back and bring it up and rehash it. And, you know, I don't believe that. I believe this. And that's why I don't believe that. And this is why I believe this. Yeah. So when Bob Thurman started calling Dakinis angels, you know, and Alan started talking about sin,
yeah. Two questions. One is, if how does the Bodhisattva and the Tantric precepts go with you life to life? What is the basis of that?
Because you said when you take them from now I until I attain awakening.
It's just like the karmic seed. Like I'm trying to think of like that with the Pratimoksha. It's a subtle form, so it's just the power of intention that keeps.
Yes, power of your intention. Okay. Yeah.
And then thinking about how the story about in ancient India, how the Buddhism died with the monasteries going down, and how that's been different in how with the Jewish community, how has that influenced your idea of how the abbey to be set up in terms of our level of outreach, or has that?
How the Jewish thing hasn't influenced my way of thinking so much, not consciously, you know, in terms of what I see, how I see the abbey is developing. I think it's important that we set up a very strong monastic community, but that our monastic community is very well integrated in society. It's not something apart from society, but we're very well integrated and we welcome lay people and we participate in social, you know, things of interest in society. I think that's quite important. But for me, that's important because of the bodhisattva nature of our tradition. Did that answer your question? Okay. So next week, Tantra. And I didn't, I kept the tantric section quite short because there's so many misunderstandings about tantra that I didn't want to get into all of that in the first volume, but save most of that for later volumes after people have an understanding of the general tradition and the general meaning, and then they'll see how tantra fits in. Yeah, right. Yeah, the last volume will be the Tantra volume, so however many we have.